Think big. Think positive. Never show any sign of weakness. Always go for the throat. Buy low, sell high. Fear, that's the other guy's problem. Nothing you have ever experienced can prepare you for the unbridled carnage you're about to witness. Right. Super Bowl, the World Series, they don't know what pressure is. In this building, it's either kill or be killed. Right. You make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners.
No prisoners.
1 minute, you're up half a million in soybeans, and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
Hello and welcome to Turner's Take Podcast. I'm your host, Craig Turner, author of Turner's Take Newsletter. I'm a commodities broker here at StoneX. We work in the futures and options markets, OTC and structured products for our hedging clients. We're both on the producing and consumer side. We offer consultant and research services too. If you have any questions for me, you can always contact me here in Chicago on my desk at 312-706-7610. You can also email me at craig.turner@stonex.com. I'm on Twitter at Turner's Take. If you guys like the podcast, please go over to iTunes and give us a positive review. And you can find the newsletter at turnerstake.com or turnerstakeag.com. If you're a client, you hear something, we need to make some changes, put something new on, you want to talk about it, please give me a call. Clients should also have my cell phone. You can call my cell and text me. If you're interested in working with us and would know what it would like to be working with me and StoneX and any of these markets, feel free to reach out anytime. So let's jump on into it. Got a lot to talk about. I was in Las Vegas for most of last week. I know there wasn't a podcast. I was thinking about it. Usually I can do it on the road, but there's just something about Las Vegas that, 4 days in Vegas is like a month somewhere else. So it just it kind of made it difficult. And then, when I did get back to Chicago on Friday, we had some kind of all-day client meetings that I got pulled into. So anyways, here we go. We're going to start fresh here. Let's talk about the big macro. Story is basically on Wednesday, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates 75 basis points. They telegraphed it. The market knew about it, but the dollar went on a tear. What really happened there? Why is the market reacting to it, for that action? One thing you got to, I think the Fed reinforced their language saying they are going to fight inflation, right? That is their number one thing. The job market's still pretty good. I think when the Fed, just a little bit of my background, just so you know, I have a double major in business and computer science undergrad. And then when I was at Goldman, they put me through my MBA at NYU, and I got an MBA in finance. And, the reason why I just bring that up is when you are in school and you have your the economist professors, the 70s comes up a lot on the inflation and the things that the Fed did, and they were facing hyperinflation in the 70s. They were raising rates, and they would raise rates and inflation would start to come down some, or at least steady, and then the Fed would take their foot off the gas and wouldn't complete kill it, right? It's like a weed. Like, you can kind of just grab the top of the weed, but if you don't get it at the root, it just springs back, right? So the only way to really get really down there in the root system and completely remove the weed of inflation would be to really kind of go over the top and just raise interest rates until you just ratcheted down the inflation to kind of get it at the bud. Right? That's the way it's explained to me. And now the professors taught it, and it makes sense. And I think that's what the Fed is taking away from this now. Like, they don't want to repeat the mistakes of the 70s, because that situation went on too long than it needed to be. And when you hear the Fed talk now, and knowing that there was, and the Fed, the central bankers understand what happened in the 70s and how they had to cure inflation the way they did, all right, and ended up having low inflation for decades after that, they're raising these rates aggressively. Here's the thing. So the Fed raises the rates 75 basis points. We're now at 3.2%. probably going to 4% by the end of the year. The next meeting's early November, and then you got one in December. So between those two meetings, everyone's expecting us to eventually, United States, be at 4% on the Fed overnight rating. The problem is, and I think this is what freaks out the market here a little bit, inflation isn't coming down. Now, I know there's been some arguments made saying, well, it's not going up. The rate of change isn't going up. Like, you know, we're in the 8% in June and 8% in, you know, July and around 8% in August or whatever it may be. And I get that. But inflation now with interest rates coming up so much, we should at least for the year over year hopefully start seeing it at 7, 6, and 5%. And we're just not seeing that. And the Fed is basically saying, we will do anything. We will do everything we can to keep inflation down. So the market then is looking at this and saying, we just went up another 75 basis points. We haven't broken yet, even on the rate of change for inflation from month to month. So, you know, the Fed's going to keep on raising rates. And I think if the inflation numbers had started to come down like 7 or 6%, we wouldn't have had that reaction to the upside in the dollar, and also these, you know, hyped up recession fears. But because the rate of change in inflation has not changed, and the Fed on Wednesday is still saying, yeah, we raised to 75, we're going to keep on going until this thing breaks. That's it. I mean, that is the cue the market needs to know, all right, Fed is all in and nothing has really changed yet. And we're going to keep on going higher with these rates. And there's no more questions about it. It is all systems go. And I think that's what happened. I think that's why the USDA and the market and the US dollar index, and then how the market also reacts to everything. So that's what's been going on. Today, it's Tuesday, it's the 27th. You know, after the big run here, we're having a little bit of a pullback in the dollar that allows commodity prices to go up a little bit, kind of lower volume this morning. It's not the big volume. So probably a dead cat bounce at some point, but that's it. Number two, I'm going to talk about the macro markets just a little bit more here. We're definitely going to focus on macros a little bit because it is going to be a big theme going forward here, at least for the next few months, if not more. When you take a look at inflation and we talk about structural inflation and we talk about transitory, you know, inflation, and, you know, the classic transitory inflation is you get a supply shock, you know, you get a war in the Middle East and, you know, some oil field blows up and, you know, all of a sudden we have lower production for 2 months. And, you know, that is a supply shock to the crude oil market. You know, what happened in the Black Sea? You get war in the Black Sea. All of a sudden there was no exports of wheat coming out of the Black Sea. That is a supply shock on the export side. You know, you get a big drought in the United States in 2012 or in Canada last year or South America over the this past winter. And all of a sudden you have tighter stocks and it takes time, either 6 months to 12 months for the markets to kind of go from very tight to at least adequate supplies. Reason being is you usually need one full cycle. Let's say the droughts in South America, you know, they need one cycle in North America to get stocks from tight to adequate. And then you need another cycle to go back down in the Southern Hemisphere to then go from adequate to burn. So that's usually it. So when you look, if you're a chartist and you look at the 6 months and the 12 month patterns, in the grain and oilseed markets, because, you know, majority of the world's grains and oilseeds are produced in the Northern Hemisphere. But then a good chunk of them, you know, on a smaller percentage, but still a good chunk of grains and oilseeds, especially oilseeds for export, are done in the Southern Hemisphere. You kind of see it, you know, takes a while for the acres to come out and the production to come out to get back to adequate to burden some stock levels. So you have all these reasons. That's transitory. That is transitory inflation that eventually comes back down. Structural inflation can exist for many reasons and are sometimes harder to identify. It's easier to identify transitory inflation. It is very much a cause and effect type of inflation. Structural inflation not always is the case, right? You know, is it all the money that we're pumping into, you know, the economy, or, you know, all the stimulus that's been going on for the past couple of years because of COVID, and, you know, the stimulus that a lot of, not just the United States, but a lot of nations put in there? Could be. Is it, you know, what's going on with energy policy, you know, moving from fossil fuels and over into renewables? And while that's, you know, in the long term, probably a very good idea. In the short term, you know, we're moving too fast and creating shortages. There's another argument out there is that, you know, labor is a big part of, there was, okay, before I get to labor, there was supply chain. I mean, when you have, because of COVID and the shutdown issues, we had supply chain, because of the COVID shutdowns, we had supply chain issues, and supply chain issues drove up the cost of goods and services. But we're starting to see that come down, and we are starting to see freight come down. At least isn't where it was, I think, before the pandemic started, but at least it's coming the other way, right? You know, where it seems like we're in the back nine now, making that turn back home, and hopefully we're starting to, you know, see a downward slope on the chart on freight costs in many different areas. What is interesting is the labor participation rate. And one thing that probably accelerated with COVID is, you know, a lot of the baby boomers, if they hadn't already been retired, you know, they probably are now, and they're not coming back to the workforce. And, you know, that part of, you know, that generation was a huge part of the workforce. So, you know, we have labor issues, and a lot of, you know, we, you know, there is a population situation where we might not just have enough people to be able to fill those roles, and it's keeping labor high. And that's a very good argument. And honestly, that's not changing. Like, the baby boomers will continue to retire and come out of the workforce until, I mean, because when you look at the, you know, the Gen Xers of the world, I mean, they're, even the oldest Gen X, I want to say they're in their mid to late 50s. You know, the youngest are in their mid 40s until you get to, you know, basically the millennials. But, you know, there's, you know, the boomers are still leaving the workforce, and we don't have basically the younger generation being as, you know, populated enough to fill some of these roles. So there's some just very good arguments for, you know, for why inflation is going on. The thing is, like, can the Fed do anything about a labor shortage, right? I mean, it can't create labor, you know, but can the Fed do anything about energy policy? Can the Fed do anything about freight costs? Can the Fed do anything, you know, about these structure, you know, although the freight costs would be transitory, but, you know, for the more structural, you know, issues, and also the Fed has no control of Congress is, you know, forgiving student debt or writing everyone a $2,000 check or, you know, or if, you know, if there's some kind of tax break, like, that's out, that is all out of the Fed's control. The only thing the Fed can do here is, you know, stop buying more, you know, assets and expanding the balance sheet and actually letting assets roll off to contract the balance sheet and not reinvest that money, and then also raise interest rates. And I think another thing is, when you take a look at the structural issues, when they raise interest rates high enough to get inflation down, it almost looks like the only thing they can really do is raise rates enough to kill demand enough to bring prices lower, which means it's the end of the day. Anyway, you know, those cards come out of the deck spells recession. If the tool of the Fed is just to raise interest rates, and that's all they have left to cut, you know, the goal of that is to cut demand. And by its very nature, it means to put us into a recession until inflation comes down. We can start all over again. It's very simplistic. I understand that. I'm sure we can get an economist on here and really go through the nuts and bolts, but probably put me to sleep and you too. But that is the big general idea of what's going on. So anyways, I know we're 13 minutes now into this podcast. I don't think we've ever gone past the 10-minute mark talking the macro markets here, but it's something that needs to be addressed just to give it, just so everyone has an idea of the landscape going forward. So with that, let's talk commodity markets. You know, energy is very sensitive to basically economic growth or, you know, or recession. So there's going to be continued pressure, I think, here on some of the, you know, on the energy markets, especially if the economy really starts to slow down. And we're now even seeing, like, banks, I think Goldman Sachs is now going to have layoffs for, like, mid-tier bankers. That came out this morning. We've already seen other companies start talking about it. You know, the mortgage rate, I think the 30-year mortgage rate now in the United States is at 7%. So that's going to be a tough road for real estate. And when you do have this aggressive rise in interest rates, to combat inflation, there are three asset classes that typically get hurt the most. One is equities, which we're seeing. Two is real estate, which hasn't kicked in yet. And, you know, I'm a homeowner. I don't want to see my value of the house go down, but I also can't put my hand in the sand about it. Like it's going to happen. And, you know, and then finally commodity prices. You know, it's just because of the demand factor. Now, demand may stay fairly constant for, let's say, you know, wheat and maybe even parts of the other grain and oil seed markets. But just like how a rising tide lifts all boats, it works on the back end too. The stocks are going to go down, energies go down, the dollar is going up. And then naturally, it's going to bring all the other commodities down, even if they held up relatively well to some of the others. Because demand stays fairly constant, but the whole market's going to kind of come down together. So, you know, that looks like to see what the playbook is. When we talk specifically about the grain markets, where we think they're going in oil seeds, heard an interesting comment the other day. They were talking about the Black Sea. And then, you know, from a logistical standpoint, we haven't had a crisis like this on global trade since World War II, when they are talking about basically the wheat market. And they're right. Like, you know, because of the Black Sea and how much the world is dependent upon wheat and corn, basically, you know, wheat and feed grains and oil seeds getting out of the Black Sea to the rest of the world, it is the biggest logistical issue that segment of the market has faced since World War II. It just is, and it's why you have this kind of risk premium and why the options in wheat particularly are so expensive compared to corn and corn and soybeans, or at least in my opinion. You know, and when we, you know, take a look at, you know, September, October, November, a lot of exports should be flowing out of the Black Sea. They've got some, and I don't think we're going to have like some kind of human catastrophe. It does seem like some of this grain will be able to get out, but it does mean that we have high prices because not all of it can get out of the Ukraine and Russia. You know, we're going to have, you know, and when, you know, we take a look at North America, it looks like the corn crop from the people I talked to in the field just early on, yields have been kind of disappointing. I wouldn't be surprised if the corn yield eventually gets to be around 170. Soybeans have been mixed. I think the USDA is probably pretty close, you know, to that 50. I wouldn't be surprised. It could even go up to 51 just because the finishing weather has been pretty good here. You know, we're just getting into harvest. But we have high prices, like corn is in the high sixes. You know, soybeans are $14. Wheat is, you know, in the nines. So prices are already high. And you look going forward, where's the risk in the market? For oil seeds, the risk is to the downside. You know, canola is going to go from having a deficit of 6 to 7 million metric tons that had to come out of the export market to probably, you know, have tight stocks, but maybe no price rationing. Depends how the crop finishes up. At worst, maybe there's a million metric tons of price rationing on the export side. That's a heck of a lot better than 6 to 7 million that we saw. And then when you plant another 20 plus, let's say 20 million acres, 21 million acres of canola next year with just a trend line yield, then all of a sudden there's no shortage in canola anymore, you know, this time next year. When you take a look at South America, we're going to plant record acres in South America. Brazil alone is going to be like 104 million acres soybeans. And the weather has been pretty good. They're even ahead of pace on planting down there. Argentina's dry, but there's still time. But South America, but Brazil alone looks fantastic, or at least as good as it you can hope for given their conditions. And you know, if they have at least an average yield in Brazil this year, it'll be a record crop because of so many acres. And always remember that, you know, they are adding 4% a year on average of farmland. And over time, that really adds up, especially over, you know, when you're, you know, you're adding that kind of farmland year over year. So, you know, there's, and in terms of the export market, more oil seeds is a greater, there's a greater percentage of oil seeds that make it to the export market in the Southern Hemisphere as compared to corn and wheat, where, especially in the wheat, that's, you know, I want to say 80% of the world's export market for originates from the Northern Hemisphere as compared to the Southern Hemisphere, which is just Australia and Argentina for the most part on the wheat side. And corn is kind of in between wheat and soybeans. So, There's a lot at stake. We need good crops. But if we do get them, if we do get a very good soybean crop out of South America, and there's no major surprises this fall in the canola and the soybeans here in North America, there is a risk that, soybeans eventually come down a few dollars. And also the canola, which is trading around 800 on the futures market, which would be, let's see, 800 divided by 44. So that's about $18 per bushel, canola. There is a risk to going eventually into the 600s. I mean, 650 canola, that's about under $15 a bushel. I mean, there is a risk of going to $14 to $15 a bushel in canola. There is a risk of going below $12 in soybeans here over the next year. Especially if the South American crop is really good. And you might be saying, hey, Craig, they don't really grow canola at all in South America. Well, all the oil seeds would, canola would be a follower. It would, really drag soybeans down, but be hard for canola to stay that high, especially since palm has already broken. We'll have some, and we're going to have, basically go from tight to adequate to maybe even burn some supply in the global soybean market, depending on how things go in South America. So just something to keep in mind. So if I'm a farmer, I'm really looking at trying to get some protection and forward sales on next year's crop, and I don't want to be left holding the bag here on any kind of thing that I'm harvesting now. If I'm a consumer and I'm, buying beans or meal or oil, I think you could just keep on going hand to mouth for a little while. Maybe you buy some calls in the far out, just in case there's a drought in South America. But in terms of the physical purchases, what they're probably most likely doing, or what I would recommend, continue to recommend, is kind of wait for the breaks. So, and the farmer needs to be kind of aggressive here, I think, on making their sales and using the futures markets to protect themselves for lower prices. That's the landscape I see for the oil seeds. The grains are a little bit different because the situation is so fluid in the Black Sea. When I take a look at the major exporters and I add in the stocks that are sitting that can't be exported out of Russia and Ukraine, and I add those back into the mix, we're as well supplied as we have been in the past 10 years, and suggest wheat is about two to three, at least $2 too expensive. However, when I take the Ukraine and Russian stocks out of the global major exporter picture, then we're as tight as we've ever been. And then in my mind, then, wheat deserves to be above $10, 11, 12 bucks. Now, neither of those things are happening. Grain is flowing out of the Black Sea. It's just, at half capacity or 60% capacity. And here we are at 8, 9, 10 bucks in the wheat market. And what's going to happen? Well, I don't know. You don't know. I mean, Putin, maybe he knows, but who really knows what's going to happen there over the next couple of weeks? Now we have these huge risk premiums. So in my mind, if I'm, and it's affecting corn too, because corn's a little bit in the same boat as wheat. So in my mind, if I'm a farmer, I'm, as I'm harvesting, I'm basically selling, taking advantage of the high prices. You think, if you want to play anything to the upside, buy some call spreads. If it gets you more comfortable selling some product, knowing you'd have some upside just in case we go up a couple of dollars. If you really want to, there's no carry in the market. I don't see the point in storing it. But if you're dead set on storage, then I'd look into put spreads. But it really wouldn't be my recommendation right now. It'd be to sell in the physical. And if you really want to kind of have a re-ownership strategy, you can buy call spreads, and that'd be for the producer side. On the consumer side, I think it's the same deal. You're buying hand to mouth. I think it does make a lot of sense to go out and buy something in the forward curve just in case, or have some calls in place in case we do go back up to 12. Because, and the only reason I would say that is you just don't know what's going to happen in that Black Sea situation. And if things go sideways fast, it's the wheat market that's the most impacted. So still a ton of uncertainty there. So even in a deflationary environment, that a recession would bring. So that's where we are. If you need any help with this, you're a client and you want to go over some of this, give me a call. If you don't work with us and you want to know more, feel free to reach out. Happy to talk to anyone anytime soon. Listen, thanks for everyone who listened. I really appreciate it. If you like the podcast, please go over to iTunes, give us a positive review, and I'll be talking to you next week. Thanks very much.
This material is conveyed as a solicitation for entering into a derivatives transaction. This material has been prepared by a Daniels trading broker who provides research market commentary and trade recommendations as part of his or her solicitation for accounts and solicitation for trades. Daniels Trading, its principals, brokers, and employees may trade in derivatives for their own accounts or for the accounts of others. Due to various factors such as risk tolerance, margin requirements, trading objectives, short-term versus long-term strategies, technical versus fundamental market analysis, and other factors, such trading may result in the initiation or liquidation of positions that are different from or contrary to the opinions and recommendations contained therein. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future performance. The risk of loss in trading futures contracts or commodity options can be substantial, and therefore investors should understand the risks involved in taking leveraged positions and must assume responsibility for the risks associated with such investments and for their results. You should carefully consider whether such trading is suitable for you in light of your circumstances and financial resources. You should read the risk disclosure accessed at www.danielstrading.com. Daniels Trading is not affiliated with, nor does it endorse any trading system, newsletter, or similar service. Daniels Trading does not guarantee or verify any performance claims made by such systems or services.